You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Dale Maharaj's father, Steve, was a Marine sergeant who served in the Pacific during World War II. When he returned, he got married, raised a family, and rarely spoke about the war, but evidence of its effect on him would surface, usually in angry rages. After his father died, Mr. Maharaj set off on a 12-year quest to track down the surviving members of his father's Marine unit to learn about their experiences fighting on Okinawa, Guam, and Guadalcanal, and he tells their stories and what he pieced together of his father's in Bringing Mulligan Home, The Other Side of the Good War, published by Public Affairs. Mr. Maharaj won the Pulitzer Prize for his book and their children after them. He's a professor at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show. Hello.
Great to be here, Leonard.
There was a photograph that helped set you off on this journey. Can you tell us about it?
I grew up with a picture of my father and another guy from the war. I don't know what it was when I was tiny. It was always in sight in his workroom. And he was a tool grinder, and he had a side business done where he would grind steel. And this picture was right next to him. And I knew it was important. And then eventually, 8 or 9 years old, he said, taken on Guadalcanal, maybe around 10 or 11, he said, one night he had been hit by a drunk driver, and he was on meds, and he got very emotional. The only time I ever saw him emotional like this, he said, they blame me, but I didn't kill him. It wasn't my fault. And they never talked about the picture again. So when he died, I decided to find out who was that guy, what happened. And the reason I set out initially on the quest was my father's rage. By the age of 12 or 13, I knew it was connected to the war somehow.
Today we would say PTSD, or not then.
Not then. Oh, no, you just get over it.
But there were phrases like shell shock. Was that ever brought up?
No, because he was in denial. He said, you just get over it. You know, forget about it. You move on. He didn't talk about the war with anybody else but me, but only in fragments.
So what did you learn about Mulligan, the guy in the picture?
I found out that after this quest, initially, that he threw a grenade into a Japanese burial tomb on Okinawa filled with 1,000 pounds, is the estimate, of munitions. And it blew up like a volcano, guys told me. My dad was standing right next to him. It was my father's second blast concussion. Mr. Mulligan, unfortunately, a piece of the tumor landed on him. And I found six guys who were there at the tomb that day.
So he actually, in effect, killed himself by accident.
By accident, exactly.
Just to get a big explosion, or was this a job?
Oh, no, this was, they thought there was machine gunners inside of the tomb, they thought. And so he didn't know the munitions were in there. So get the machine gunners. But it turned out later that intelligence had suspected there were munitions in the tomb. And my father was squad leader, so...
But why that picture, this being so significant? There must have been many other stories that he had to tell, which he didn't tell, it seems.
Well, in pieces he told them. And the quest, when I learned about what happened, I never actually, could learn much more about Mulligan. All of his ancestors died and didn't have other children. But it became a bigger story about the war and its impact on these 29 guys I found, 12 of them who are in the book. And they're all messed up. Not all. Most were messed up by the war.
Ironically, their company was called Love Company?
Yeah, it was L Company, 3rd Battalion, and in the vernacular of the day, it was Love Company.
Where was he stationed, and what battles was he in?
Battle of Guam, Battle of Inuitok, Battle of Guam, Battle of Okinawa. They were on Guadalcanal after the battle as a staging area.
And when he had that what can we call it, concussion, mm-hmm. Was that considered a wound at the time?
No.
Would that get you the Purple Heart?
No, you had to bleed to get a Purple Heart. He got a Purple Heart on Guam. A mortar round landed behind him and blew up and killed the guys in the foxholes on either side. He died with Japanese steel in his back. That got him his Purple Heart, got him into Arlington. But in those days, they recognized traumatic brain injury as an issue. And I learned in my research, my father's two blast concussions were extreme, and there's things called axons in the brain. The scientist, Dr. Smith at Penn, University of Pennsylvania, told me, it's like silly putty. If you pull it slowly, it stretches. But if you snap, like in a concussion, they snap, they never grow back together. And his behavior was directly related. He says that's typical of blast concussion guys.
So do you have a sense of what your father was like before he went into the military?
For my aunts, yes. He didn't have that rage. He grew up in poverty. He had issues, but he came back different.
Why do you think it was important to find the men your father served with?
Well,
I mean, you devoted a large chunk of your life to doing this.
Yeah, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of phone calls over the years. I never got to talk to my father the way I wanted to. And with these guys, and I met with some of them so many times, they became surrogate. I have like a dozen surrogate fathers. And it's terrible because someone just died about a month ago. And I feel very close to these guys. So I got to know my father through them.
Well, we're talking about looking for them 60 years after the war ended. You just can't Google somebody and find them, can you?
And a lot of them did not want to talk about the war. Like your father. Like my father. There was one fellow, Mr. Rossblock, in particular. When I called him, I said, is the Mr. Rossblock who was on Okinawa? And he said, hostile, what do you want him for? And I blurted about the tomb and the blowing up, and there was silence. And then he whispered, I was there. And he was very tenuous. I sent him a picture. I said, can I talk to you again after I send you the picture of Mulligan and we can talk some more? The next time I called, he talked for an hour. At the end, he said, you're the first person I've ever talked to the war about.
He admitted that he had cracked up in the war. He had the equivalment of a mental breakdown?
Well, that's Joe Lanciotti, a different Joe.
Oh, I thought that was Joe Repstein.
Yeah, both Joes. I mean, both Joes are intense. Yeah, Joe Lanciotti lives over here in New Jersey. He wrote a self-published book called The Timid Marine. 26,000 guys cracked up in Okinawa, lost it in battle, and nobody wants to talk about it. He, in his 70s, late 70s, decided to do a book and say, we got to, you know, for kids today, you know, who are in wars, for their children of those soldiers, they need to hear this.
Now, there have been lots of books written about the Pacific, the Battle of the Pacific. Did you find that talking to these men, you got a different view of history, a history that has been untold?
It's an untold story because they talked about the atrocities. Mr. Palmisani told me how he bayoneted. There was a Japanese prisoner who spoke perfect English. They captured him on Guam. He went to Stanford University, and he asked for a Lucky Strike cigarette, and Palmisani said, I'll give you a Lucky Strike, and he stabbed him in the neck. The policy was, kill all prisoners. Another man, Mr. Lockridge, told me about how he pulled the gold teeth out of Japanese cadavers, and he regretted it at the end. It was confessions almost from some of these guys.
And were their stories consistent?
Oh, absolutely. Some of these guys hadn't talked to each other in 60 to 70 years spanning the time that I worked on this, and they told the same incidents the same.
And they also told you that they rarely, if ever, talked about the war, and yet they seemed to remember every detail.
Something about getting older, Mr. Grainard in particular, their memories got more cinematic over the years, and I thought, are they remembering false memories? But as I said, they were collaborated by the other guys. Something about hitting their 80s made them open up. I couldn't have gotten this story 20 years ago.
So when they talked to you about killing prisoners and civilians, were they expressing remorse?
Mr. Palmisani didn't, but Mr. Lockridge definitely did. My father, and one of his last things he said was about the Japanese soldier he killed in broad daylight, came up out of the bushes, and it was me or him, he said, eye to eye. And it was one of the last things on his brain.
But that is something we can understand. That's different than shooting a man who asks you for a cigarette.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Palmisani was pretty rough.
Did they remember your father?
Some of them did. Oh, yeah. Some of them by name. Some of them, one guy, Mr. Popovich, I wish I could have seen Steve one more time. He was just so, he was so remorseful that he couldn't have met my dad one last time.
Well, you are searching to some degree for your father as much as for the deeper story here. Did they tell you things about him that you felt you needed to know?
Oh, I heard some good stories, just more fun stories than anything. They made the illegal booze on Guadalcanal. My dad stole the raisins, for instance. To get the sugar, and they broke into the officers' quarters and stole their booze. Fun things like that. But more important was the context of these guys were within feet of him in these foxholes when these things were happening, and I finally got to converse with him through them about it.
And many of them talked about concussions and blast concussions. As we mentioned earlier, we know now that they cause traumatic brain injury. Did they have similar experiences afterward? Did they also have fits of rage?
Well, Mr. Rossblach was treated. He went to the Portsmouth Naval Facility for 6 months, and he said, I was really edgy and unstable. Some of the guys came back better than others, and I learned it depends where you are where the blast concussion happens, how many you've been exposed to, and everyone acts differently. Reacts differently to them.
Well, they must have heard about PTSD in connection with the current situations in Iraq and Afghanistan. Did that ease them, ease their minds at all? Did it explain things for them? Because we often hear that Marines, especially the Marine culture, doesn't really allow people to, puts them into denial when they're having these kinds of problems.
Yes. Some of them were... About 20-30% were reflective enough to do that. There were several guys. Tom Price in Los Angeles was very reflective on these things, and he talked about how, Dale, we love war. We're always at war. And what's interesting, Leonard, is to a man, these are almost all really conservative guys, they all were against Iraq and Afghanistan. Why are we there? Why are we doing this to our kids? So, and I didn't ask that question. It came from them organically.
Now, when they had themselves labeled the greatest the greatest generation, first of all, did they even talk about that?
None of them refer to themselves as the greatest generation. No one ever used the term good war. My father, I asked him several times about heroics or actions, and he said, and it's the epigraph of the book, he says, there are no heroes, you just survive. And to a man, none of them glorified it as a great anything. It was war.
Well, when I've spoken to members of the military who have served in more recent wars, they all talk about not thinking about the cause, but rather about the family situation, their fellow soldiers, and how they've all bonded, even if they never would have bonded back home.
Right. But there was a myth about the family in Okinawa. They had 200% casualties in my father's company. That means the guys were cycling in and out. He says, by the end, most guys didn't know the guy next to him. So in that battle, it wasn't a band of brothers.
Wasn't there one soldier who felt he was a coward? That has to be a problem with soldiers in general, the ones who run or the ones who do something that is not expected of them as Marines.
Well, Mr. Rossblach, when the blast happened, they took him to the hospital. He was out of it. And he says some guy years later talked about these crybaby Marines and PTSD, and he was telling me, I'm not a crybaby Marine. And he wasn't. He was a very brave man. But he was afraid of being branded a crybaby Marine.
You asked him about the death of Mulligan.
All of them.
And they all told pretty much the same story?
All the same story. Nobody blamed my father. I surmise what happened is my father, a squad leader, ordered Mulligan to throw the grenade, or when the tomb hit him, he tried to stop the bleeding and his dog tags came off. I learned that Mulligan was a hemophiliac. He shouldn't have been in the war in the first place.
But your father felt that he was responsible?
I think what all these guys share in common from blast concussion is the confusion after. No one can remember clearly what happens. My father somehow took it on himself that he was being blamed by everybody. No one blamed him.
My guest is Dale Maharaj, who's been teaching at the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia University since 2001, just a few years after he won the Pulitzer for his second book, And Their Children After Them. That was in 1990. His latest is called Bringing Mulligan Home, The Other Side of the Good War. It is published by Public Affairs. And you're calling it the Good War because you want to make the point that not everybody would term it that way if they really understood what was going on.
Exactly. It's a complicated, yes, it's a statement, but it's not a statement. It's I have to address it.
In a lot of these men, including your father, had souvenirs from the war. Can you talk about those? What kinds of things did they save?
Well, when I was 8 or 9 years old, my mother used to boost me up into the attic through the crawl space to throw down the boxes for Christmas. And there was a chest up there of items from Japanese people my father brought back. And when I got old enough, I would sneak up there and look at them. And there was a passport. There was a training manual. And I was obsessed with these objects. Well, because of this project, I had the opportunity to go to Okinawa and find those families, and I did. And it was very intense.
And your father saved those things, but he never went through the box?
They meant nothing to him, you know, later.
So why did he save them?
I don't know.
You could have thrown them out.
But he kept them. It's just, I think they were iconographic, you know, something about the exoticism of being in the war, memories. I don't know. All the guys saved stuff, and none of them could explain to me why they saved it.
And some of the things are rather ghoulish, like those gold teeth that they pulled out.
Yes. Mr. Lockridge, unfortunately, I call that chapter, you know, he so regretted that. Lockridge's gold, he had a pocket full of them by the end. And then he got wounded, and the medics, when they cut his pants off, the gold teeth scattered into the mud. He lost his gold. It was like it was cosmically meant to be.
So he thought he was going to save this gold and have something value after he came home?
He called it his war bonus. And as I say, he regretted it. And it was to his dying breaths, he regretted it.
There was one man who stood apart from the others, a man named Kennedy. Mm-hmm. Had your father talked about him?
My father grew up listening to my dad talk about Kennedy. He hated Kennedy, and he worshipped him. And he hated him and all the guys hated him. Kennedy raped a woman on Okinawa. The worship came from, he was from here in New York City, from Park Avenue, for money. My father, being working class, growing up in the Depression, said, having money means you have all these things. And he kept talking about this. Kennedy lived on Park Avenue. And so he idolized him and hated him at the same time.
Because he was not like the others. They had all joined the Marines during the Depression. They were poor. He was somebody who had other options open to him.
Kennedy could have not gone. He was a psychopath. He told me, I wanted to bayonet Japs. That was a quote from him. So he wanted to go in and kill people. My dad didn't want to do that.
And you spoke with Kennedy.
I met him. He lives in a very rural place. I tracked him down, and I wanted to talk about the rape. And when I went there, I walked into his little shack in the woods down a dirt road, and there was a pistol holster on the bed. I walked into the living room. There was a revolver holster on the leather couch. House was immaculate otherwise. He was sitting on an overstuffed chair with a blanket over him. And he made it clear there was a Colt Python underneath the blanket. Now, you want to interview me?
You want to ask me about whether I raped a woman?
Yeah, I did, but I didn't push it. Let's just say I'm brave, but I'm not that brave, Leonard.
And what did he tell you?
This is the hardest thing as a journalist, is you not open your mouth. And you radio guy, you know that better than us print people. But I said, my father said something happened in Okinawa. Yeah, he said. And he stared at me coldly. And I just stared back, and he finally said, I heard two guys did something to a woman. I said, that's what I heard. I just stared. So he went on and on about what happened, and I said, you know who they were? And he said, nah. That's as much as he would address it.
How old was he?
86 when I interviewed him.
Uh-huh.
And he was still scary. Mr. Greenert, when I called Mr. Greenert I was going to go, Mr. Greenert watched him shoot two babies. And Greenert was crying 65 years later, as he told me this. I told Greenert I was going to go see Kennedy. He said, take a gun. Take a gun.
Why did you want to go to Okinawa to cover the story? Was it important to actually see where your father had served?
I hate the psychobabble term closure, but you never have closure. But I had to see where things happened. I had to meet the people. I met the soldiers and the civilians on the other side. I had to meet them.
And had any of the other veterans gone back?
A couple had, actually.
Because a lot of a lot of Vietnam vets have gone to Vietnam, and I'm assuming somewhere down the line veterans will be going to Iraq and to Afghanistan.
Yes.
What do they hope to find there?
I think, like me, they're looking for ghosts, although their ghosts are, you know, personal. Mine are removed by my father. I call it the Island of Ghosts. Every place there, the battles are – it's all built up now, but the battles and all the things, that they're all there. I went into a cave and I found rotting Japanese soldiers and American grenade fragments. This is the last hill my father's company assaulted. Most likely those grenades were thrown by the guys I interviewed.
Were you able to track down the families of soldiers who had been killed? Any of the Okinawan victims of these killings?
There was Mrs. Onishi, who was running ahead of my dad's company. 150,000 civilians died in that battle. And it wasn't that my dad wasn't shooting civilians. They didn't want to hurt women. It was our naval bombs and our aerial bombs. There were 16 family members in her family when they left Naha, the city, by the end of the battle, 13 were dead.
So do they still blame Americans? Are they still bitter?
No, the Okinawans were amazingly warm and open. I was shocked over and over how warm and open they were.
You met a man named Yamada, who was in the Japanese army in World War II. What was his war experience?
Oh, his friend Tatsuo was killed. And he was one of the very few. 110,000 Japanese soldiers died. Only 7,000 lived. He, since 1954, I want to take you somewhere. So we go to this jungle. And there's this beautiful trail. And I thought, just like a tourist hiking trail. We go to this, and it dead ends in the jungle. It's where Tatsuo died. He'd been going since 1954, twice a week. That trail was made by his feet, praying to his dead friend.
You also found the place where Mulligan died.
Oh, it was easy to find the tomb. I had the battle map from Captain Hagler, the guy's descriptions. Part of the site was still blown out, grown in with jungle.
So they gave you accurate descriptions 60 years later?
Total accurate. Totally accurate.
When you started digging and started talking to the men in your father's Marine unit, did any of them talk about, you said none of them talked about it being a good war or them being the greatest generation or any of that. It's just a matter of survival. But also, what about the other side, the atrocities? They were discussed a little bit at the time. Norman Mailer, in fact, in his first and probably greatest novel, he has a scene in the Pacific in which something like that happens. But that was rarely discussed.
No. You know, the reason this book was very hard to do, I've been a journalist for 35 years. I reported my own family, my father's situation. I stopped doing it in the middle. I was too hard. My mother had cancer, and I realized, and some of the guys said, the kids today have to know. And I realized the kids of today's soldiers have to know what my father, because they're going to go up in houses with people who have blast concussion injuries like my dad. And that pulled me back. Their voices and my own experience said we have to tell today. So there's lessons for today in all this.
So I said, today is the 10th anniversary, in fact, of the invasion of Iraq. Did writing this book shed any light on any of the other war narratives that you've read?
Yeah, well, you know, I've been in two wars myself as a journalist covering them. So I don't have a lot of experience with war, but a little bit. But they're all the same. We have different technologies. The impact on people, that's a constant.
They are trying to change that now with drones, distancing the military from targets. But in the end, it really still is about targeting somebody and killing them.
You know, you can shoot somebody in the eye like my dad did. Look him in the eye, or you can kill him with a drone. They're just as dead, and there's no conscience with a drone.
What kinds of reactions have you gotten from this book? Did the families of the veterans you spoke with get in touch with you?
Oh, my gosh. Oh, I sent early copies to everybody. Jim Lockridge's daughter said, you helped him get the poison out of his system at the end. Thank you. I had an email from a Vietnam vet the other day who said, that was my father. That's my experience in Vietnam. And he closed the email by saying, thank you for laying down on the barbed wire so the rest of it could get across. The book's been out for a week, and I've gotten like 20 or 30 of these so far.
Just one more thing. When you looked at the official records of things like what happened when Mulligan died or the rape, what did you find? Had they been covered over by the military?
There were no records. The Marines...
Kennedy's rape was not really discussed?
You will not find anything in National Archives, all destroyed or not written down in the first place.
Dale Maharidge, Maharidge. His book, Bringing Mulligan Home, The Other Side of the Good War, is published by Public Affairs. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Leonard.